From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with Ron Spencer about Theater on the Square.
I'll talk with local historian David Bagdad about his new book on the worst team in baseball history, the 1962 Mets.
Aw, and I'll find out about a new production of Tuesdays with Maury in Greenfield and other places. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Ron Spencer of Theater on the Square wants to teach you how to make a successful relationship circa 1959. Sharon Gamble invited the founder of Tots in to tell us about the birds and the bees and the assorted fruits and vegetables going on in Theater on the Square this season.
So I understand you've learned some things recently and are continuing to learn them for like one more performance about contemporary marriage circa 1950-something?
A Contemporary American's Guide to a Successful Marriage, copyright 1959 by Robert Bastrod. A delightful romp through the idyllic state of marriage, what we considered, you know, to be ideal back then.
Like what we might have seen on television?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, Donna Reed, all those. Of course, marriage as this, what is the slogan that we use for it? Marriage is no better or worse back then than it is now. But it's really kind of an interesting story about how people are put together in kind of an idyllic situation, and then it turns out it's not ideal at all.
What? I'm shocked.
And then some unlikely people end up together who are well-suited. So it's really a wonderful comedy
that
with mostly what we do at Theater on the Square. I don't know whether I'm becoming a Pollyanna, Sharon, or what, but it seems that most of our shows are lighthearted in a way. They're comedy-based. And yet there's definitely always a lesson in there. Mm-hmm. There's always a curve. There's always something to be learned, and usually a pretty important lesson, I hope.
Tots is how old? Remind us.
We're 24 years old, going on a quarter of a century.
You're going to have a quarter-life crisis next year?
I don't think so. I think we're fine. It's always a struggle, you know, for the arts, especially for, you know, institutions like Theater on the Square and the Phoenix Theater. You know, they're reputable theaters. They've been around a number of years. They do good work, not necessarily mainstream work.
Yeah.
And here in Indiana, you know, when you're not in the mainstream, you're definitely in a minority. You sense that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet our audiences and our, you know, our patrons are very loyal, and that says a great deal to me
mm-hmm.
about the value of the institution and that Theater on the Square is an important part of the fabric, the cultural fabric in the city.
Absolutely. And you've never lacked for scripts. You've never thought to yourself, I don't know if I can find enough good plays to make a season.
Seemingly no. The more we've moved into our identity,
mm-hmm.
Seemingly the new playwrights are there.
Mm-hmm.
We rarely do traditional or classical kind of work. I mean, because I think art should be forward thinking and looking ahead. To me, reflection is good,
mm-hmm.
but I think the real lessons are to be learned from the voices now, looking at where we are and thinking about where we're going to go and how we're going to get there and how are we going to react to being there and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately there are a number of playwrights who many have never been produced on Broadway, but have been produced in Chicago and San Francisco and L.A. and off-Broadway, you know, that are really remarkable writers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They have wonderful voices. And like I say, the emphasis on humor right now, I just think that's so important to laugh. And we get a real kick out of those kinds of shows that just let you see the humorous side of even a serious situation.
Speaking of which, who is George Winters? He's been described as the gay Tom Lehrer.
He is a genius, flat out. The man is, he's lived in New York, I guess, most of his adult life, and is a composer of the most unique parodies and songs that comment on life situations in a very humorous way. Again, George, definitely his emphasis is on seeing the humorous side of things, the irony, you know, the sarcasm and all. He's won several Off-Broadway awards as a composer, and he did a show in New York called A Monday in the Dark with George,
no.
Which is, of course, a takeoff from Sondheim Sunday in the Park with George. And it was very successful. He had Jay Rogers and several other people who have been on and off Broadway there working with him. And he never really structured it as a show, per se. Jeannie Logan, who is a longtime friend of mine and done some marvelous work at Theater on the
great
Square.
Great music director and singer.
I mean, great vocal director. You can't get better. She has done, Miss Mona and Best Little... House of Ill Repute in Texas, Whorehouse. I don't know if we can say that or not. But she was Miss Mona in that, and she was in The Mother in Blood Brothers, and she was in The Great American Trailer Park Musical, just really done some wonderful things at the theater. And she and I have talked for years, of course, about George Winters, and he composed for her some songs when she was doing cabaret back in New York at start of her career, as the song says.
Huh.
One of the songs that she's known for singing here in town is The Girl Who Put the Sin in Cincinnati and the O in the Ohio. And George wrote that for her, and it is great. I mean, to hear her do this song, and his lyrics just come at you a mile a minute. You really have to listen. It's
so is it like a musical review? Or is
exactly.
There,
yeah, it is a musical review, and we string it together with a little dialogue now and then, a little commentary. I come out in one scene as a general who is recruiting for the military, and they said that since the United States Army is an all-volunteer organization now, that the numbers have slacked off, so they're going to begin a gay recruiting effort, which they're launching at a cabaret in Indianapolis to be very hush-hush. But they're ultimately going to Provincetown and Fire Island and Key West and San Diego, San Francisco. And the song is called Fight Fiercely Fairies. And it is hilarious. I mean, I sing another song called I'd Planned You a Marvelous Funeral to the corpse of my deceased lover.
Oh,
it's
goodness.
Very funny, though, which deals with actually what a partner might want for that funeral as opposed to what the family might want. And I'm sure everybody goes through that, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual, whatever. And it's just amazing. I can't even remember some of the numbers. She was pure as the snow, but she drifted. And Piano Bar Hell, which we've all been in. It's just marvelous, and it's going to run about probably an hour and 50 minutes with intermission, and it's I'm joined by Jeannie Logan, whom I mentioned, and the incredibly talented Sean Baker. We know him as Sean Baker, the music maker, and he's been playing, piano in various restaurants and bars around the city, and done some wonderful composing as well. He's an incredibly talented man. And David Mathias, who was last on our stage in a little pistache called When Pigs Fly some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just a great group. And it's just the four of us, so we're having a blast, of course. And lots of costume changing and, much grabbing of props and things. But it's all about, with George, it's all about the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to sing. I am so fortunate. This never happens to me, Sharon, because I'm really an actor, more so than a singer. But George wrote a song that he specifically wanted me to sing called It Gets Better, about gay teen suicide.
Oh.
It will break your heart.
It's how timely.
It is exquisite. I mean,
wow.
And that I get to sing the 11 o'clock number, you know.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Well earned.
Well, I was honored that George felt that it's a number that I should do. I think because of my age.
Yeah, sure.
And it definitely comes from his personal experience, having been tormented and tortured as an obviously kind of effeminate young man, you know, as so many kids are. Well, not just effeminate, but different.
Yeah.
In school. Yes, the life you choose to live begins the day you choose to live.
Hmm. Oh, that's beautiful.
Oh, it's an absolutely stunning song.
It kind of circles us back around, though, to the entertainment, but there's something in there. There's a core. There's a
absolutely.
Message in there.
Yeah, he has a every song has a message.
Yeah. Ron, this is kind of your marriage season, because after finishing up with the Contemporary American's Guide to a Successful Marriage circa 1959, and then after a show by George, then you have The Kids Left, The Dog Died, Now What?
Exactly.
What is this about, and who is Carol Kaplan Lahner?
Carol Kaplan Lahner is one of those young authors who's come out of kind of nowhere, and she'd written several things before, but this was her first success in New York City, off Broadway. And it's about, actually, a subject near and dear to my heart, being a baby boomer who's dating, trying to find someone to date. This isn't after the dog has died and the kids are gone, what do we do with our lives? Do we drive off to Florida for the winter, or what do we do? And it's mostly about relationships, continuing relationships. For those people who lose a partner, do I find another partner? Is that even an option? There again, it's comedy, mostly comedy, but it has some really poignant moments in it, too, as well. Great music. Julie Inskeep, who's done a lot of work on our stage, will be directing. And I know that Darren Gowan, who's incredibly talented, he's been in the Great American Trailer Park Musical and in bed with Chuck and Lois and some wonderful shows at the theater. He'll be in the show, joined by Dave Ruark and Janet Ransdell, who's incredibly talented. We don't see her a lot around here because she's from Martinsville, and she worked a lot in Brown County at the showcases down there, but she's coming in for the show. And then if anyone knows anyone, we're looking for a wonderful soprano who's about age 45 to 55, because you need to have that age there. The show speaks to experience.
Sharon Gamble with Ron Spencer of Theater on the Square. Learn more about TOTS at TOTS.org. That's TOTS.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. As the thoughts of baseball fans turn to spring training, no matter what team they support, they can all agree on one thing: not to be like the 1962 Mets. That team, often referred to as the worst baseball team ever, is also one of the teams most beloved by fans of the game because of all the quirky characters who are a part of it. David Bagdad, an Indianapolis author, musician, and baseball fan, has recently written a history of the team titled A Year in Mudville, an Oral History of Casey Stengel and the Original Mets. Our own Mets fan, Travis DiNicola, invited David in to talk about the book.
You're sitting here with a Mets jersey on, a Casey Stengel jersey, and I'm thinking about baseball right now. And, you know, we're recording this the week that all the teams are sending pitchers and catchers down to spring training. Actually, by the time it airs, a lot of the position players will be there. So it seems like a perfect time to talk about a baseball book. I need to be honest about something up front, though, and that is I have been a Mets fan pretty much all my life. And I have to say, when I heard that there was a guy in town who had written a book about the first year of the Mets, 1962, my thought was, please, let's make sure that he actually lives in Indianapolis so I have a reason to interview him. Because, you know, we do try to keep things locally focused on Art of the Matter. We don't, you know, normally talk about New York City baseball teams here.
Of course. And since you've made your disclaimer, I need to make one of my own.
Please.
Which is that I have basically never been a Mets fan in my entire life, and I'm still not really one today.
Now, this is the part that just kind of blows me away. I know that, I mean, you're originally from Chicago, but have lived in Indianapolis a number of years. But you're not even a Mets fan. So how did you even decide? Because I think you've been working on this book, what, about 8 years or so? How did you even decide?
January 1st was 9 years.
Wow. To take this on. Why? I know you're a baseball fan, but
it's the story.
Yeah.
It's the story, pure and simple. Everybody likes a great story, whether it's baseball or whatever each individual person's interest might be. I spent many years playing folk music, and there's a long tradition in folk music of the story being king over everything. And I read an article about the Mets in Sports Illustrated, the 62 Mets, mm-hmm. in 1992, the 30th anniversary piece, for those of you a little bit slow on the math. And it was very gripping. And I found myself making a photocopy of the article, and then every once in a while, when I needed a laugh, I would just go back and reread it. And it just took hold of me.
I mean, was there one thing from that article you read back in 92 that really, that you even still remember now? I mean, was it like one of Casey Stengel's strange quotes or one specific story that just stood out of like, you know, this was a miserable but lovable team?
It would be impossible to pin just one down. There were so many things. Going back to even before the team was formed and then the process by which, after the franchise was awarded, they set up operations. There were just all sorts of comical little incidents, some of which were probably made up just because they sounded good, but some mm-hmm. of which actually happened. And then, of course, the events of the first season, which obviously we'll talk about in more detail. Well, and then the legend itself that has surrounded the team since then.
And it is a legend. I mean, you know, people who are fans of baseball and baseball history look back at that team, and, you know, many say the worst team ever, worst team of the century, what have you, but a team that just had so many great stories. A lot of that is, of course, because of the manager, Casey Stengel, and his strange way of speaking. Also just some great players, and I want to talk all about that in a second. But, you know, one thing real quick, though. The title of your book is A Year in Mudville, An Oral History of Casey Stengel and the Original Mets. For those maybe who aren't picking up the reference, where does Mudville come from? What is Mudville?
Mudville comes from the very famous Thayer poem, Casey at the Bat. Casey was the star player of the Mudville Nine.
The Mudville Nine.
Described in the poem. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole big build-up about how the Mudville Nine was doing very poorly in a particular day. And, if only Casey could come up. And it was the bottom of the ninth, and they're down by a run or two, and they have two runners on, and Casey comes up, and of course, he strikes out.
And amazingly enough, that poem was not written about Casey Stengel.
No.
But we'll get to more about Casey Stengel in a minute. Briefly, just sort of set the stage for us, because when the New York Mets came to be, they were part of baseball's first expansion of the National League, and the history of that alone that you detail in your book is fascinating for any baseball fan, whether they like the Mets or not, just sort of how that all came to be. Briefly sort of give me the background on why the Mets even exist.
Well, I think in order to really understand that, you have to look at the era in which they were formed. After World War II, both leagues were really dominated by the three New York baseball teams, the Yankees in the American League, and the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers in the National League. And there were almost no, in fact, I don't believe there were any seasons between, I'm going to make sure I get this right, between 1949 and 1957 in which there was not one New York
team
in the World Series.
At least one of those three, yeah.
Yes, and very often, I mean, the Yankees and the Dodgers seem to be perpetually squaring.
Sure. And then the Dodgers and the Giants both go off to California.
Right. And it was an era where baseball mattered a lot more than it does now. Baseball was much, it's a cliche to say it's a way of life, but we didn't have the kind of entertainment stimulus overload that we have these days. And it was a much more social climate in general in the world and in New York in particular at that time. So you really do see instances of people sitting on their front stoops arguing with each other heatedly about whether Mickey Mantle or Duke Snider was the better center fielder and whether either of them could carry Willie Mays' glove.
There is a whole lot of finagling. I mean, people wanted another team in New York. They wanted another team to root for, especially a National League team. And there was a whole lot of finagling as far as how that was going to happen and how that expansion was going to happen and where they were going to play. But it really came down to sort of two people that have quite a lot to do with it. One being an attorney, mm-hmm. William Shea, who Shea Stadium's named after. And then a woman, sort of a multimillionaire, Joan Payson. Right?
That's right.
Tell me a bit about them.
Okay. After the Giants and Dodgers left, I mean, there have been all sorts of rumblings that they were going to go, and there were all kinds of warning signs, and the city basically sat on its hands and just kind of assumed that it would all work out. And then once they actually left, the city woke up and said, oh, my God, what are we going to do about this? And the mayor, who was very shortly to be up for re-election, formed what was called a mayor's baseball committee headed by Bill Shea, who was an attorney who had no involvement with either the Giants or the Dodgers or any other baseball team. He was just an attorney with a lot of political connections and a reputation for getting things done. So he kind of headed this committee and tried first to convince another major league team, another National League team, to relocate to New York. And then when that didn't work, he tried to convince the major leagues to expand. And when that didn't work, he got a bunch of wealthy people together and decided to form a third major league, which became the Continental League. And even though the Continental League fell on its sword and disappeared more than 50 years ago, there's still a lot of debate today as to whether that whole thing was just a bluff to try and force the major league owners to expand, which, of course, is exactly what happened.
A pretty amazing bluff it was.
It
worked. And then
that's how New York got their National League Baseball team.
And one thing that I love about the Mets is that when they chose their colors, they specifically did choose the blue and the orange, the blue representing the Dodgers that had left, the orange representing the Giants that had left, and named their team the Metropolitan so that they were really a team for all of the boroughs in New York and all of New York.
That's right, because the other teams all had an identification with one borough or other.
Sure.
Obviously,
Brooklyn.
And the Giants played their games in the Polo Grounds, which was in Manhattan. So that was their patch.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Yankees were in the Bronx.
Now, the team, and we'll talk a little bit more about how they lost and how they found so many different ways to lose in a moment, or to lose in just
how
a moment.
How much time do you have?
Yeah. One thing that I really sort of struck by as I was reading your book was how, the other expansion team, Houston, really focused on developing new players and such. But the Mets really focused on, okay, how are we going to bring people into to see this team, and focused on sort of, great personalities of baseball that they made part of the team, even if maybe some of these guys were past their prime. How much of that, part of that, it seemed to come from this real push for great PR. Was any of that driven by Joan Payson? We mentioned Joan Payson before. She was really the owner of the team, and she was the person who put all the money behind the team.
She was, and she was really kind of a remarkable woman. When you look at her and you read her background, you wouldn't think that this would be a very likely person to end up owning a baseball team. But in fact, she was a huge baseball fan. She'd been attending Giants games at the Polo Grounds for probably 50 years before they left.
Wow.
And she was one of the richest women in America. She was heir to a substantial fortune, and she married another multimillionaire. And she had the wherewithal and the motivation to fund first the Continental League New York franchise, and then ultimately the Mets.
Yeah, and she loved baseball.
She did.
That was her passion. There's a great story you have about what. Let me see if I got this right. She was in Europe for a while during the beginning of the season, and so she had her chauffeur go to every game, keep the box score, and send it. And then when she kept on getting all these box scores of the Mets losing and losing and losing again, she said, "Well, wait until they win to let me know." And then she said she didn't hear anything from America for a long time after. That's just awful.
Yeah, that's correct.
One of the most brilliant decisions made, I think, about the 62 Mets was having Casey Stengel be the manager.
Absolutely.
Tell me about Casey Stengel. I mean, he was, a huge, huge baseball figure in New York for many reasons.
Well, Casey Stengel actually is the only person to wear the uniform of all four New York baseball teams, the Yankees, the old Giants, the old Dodgers, and the Mets. Just a little bit of trivia there.
That's pretty cool.
You can win a barroom discussion with that one there.
He had been a successful manager with the Yankees,
that he is the most successful manager of all time, brought in to manage the Yankees, who were the flagship franchise in baseball, then and now.
Yeah.
And he then proceeded to, he was with them for 12 years. They won 10 American League pennants. They won the World Series the first 5 years that he was the manager, which no manager has ever managed to do before or since.
Mm-hmm.
And, 10 pennants, 7 World Series championships. And then after they lost the World Series in 1960, the Yankees, for a variety of hazy reasons, let him go.
Yeah. And what I love is that when he announced that he was going to be the Mets manager, he did it a year to the date and in the same room where he was fired by the Yankees.
That's correct.
I mean, great sense of theater that all these guys had. One story I want to jump to just a little bit here is in the book you talk about how Casey Stengel was having a problem with some of these guys. Maybe some of them were staying out too late and trying to figure out which ones had been staying out too late. And tell me a story about the baseball in the elevator.
Oh, that's a classic Stengel tale. Again, this is one of those where it's impossible to verify whether this actually happened, but There's a catcher named Joe Ginsberg who was with the 62 Mets for about 20 minutes and has since popped up in all kinds of interviews over the last 50 years. Came in late one night with a bunch of other guys who'd been out, and it was one of the old-style elevators that had an operator. And the operator pulled a baseball out of his pocket and said, "Hey, would you guys mind signing this baseball for me?" And they all said sure and didn't think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day in the clubhouse, Stengel comes out and says, you, into my office right now. And said, "You guys didn't make curfew." And they said, "Well, how do you know that, Casey?" He says, "Well, I gave the elevator operator that ball." And so that's how I know that you guys didn't make curfew.
That's fantastic. That's such a great story. I mean,
he knew every trick and had probably invented most of them.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and the way that he comments about the team, I mean, you know, one of the most famous quotes he's always had is, you know, that these guys could find new ways of losing and mm-hmm. such, you often hear. One I had not heard before that I thought was hysterical was talking about, you know, at opening day, there were so many guys on the team that had so many big families that you write, you know, they probably set a record for fathering children, and that Stengel told the press that if they can produce as well on the field as they do off the field, then we'll win the pennant.
That's right.
Well, that didn't happen. But, you know, one comment I just want to make is, I mean, there's so many enjoyable things about this book, but I have to say that Chapter 6, which is all about the first month that they were actually playing, if you're going to read anything, I would read that. Because that particular month and that chapter really, I think, gives you a great sense of all the craziness that was around this team, that went in this team, their ridiculously long losing streaks that they had. And yet, you know, things like they had so many games where they would lose by just one run, you know. And that's, I mean, now, of course, there were a lot of games they lost by more than one run.
Well, they developed kind of a specialty for however far they were down, they would manage some kind of late-inning rally that more often than not would fall short.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and just that little bit of hope, and then you know, it'd be over with. And then
they lost 120 games, but it's amazing how many of them they actually managed to get the tying run to the plate.
Yeah, I mean, they were in many of these games. They were competitive, and they had some great guys. They just never could seem to get it together. And I think probably the best example of that is on June 17th.
A classic day that will
live in infamy for the fans of baseball and the Mets. There's almost too many things to talk about that went wrong on this particular day, but give me one of the highlights about Marvelous Marv here.
Well, this is the quintessential day in Mets history, at least in the first year, as far as I'm concerned. They brought in Marvelous Marv Thronberry, who was a first baseman who had played with the Yankees, come up with the Yankees, and hadn't really been able to do well there, so he bounced around a little bit. And Stengel brought him in because they needed a first baseman who had some power. And Marv Thronberry was that. Now, there were all kinds of theories as to where the Marvelous Marv name came from.
Right.
And I've actually collected all of them in one place for the first time in this book. But you're going to have to read it in order to enjoy that.
Fair enough.
But June 17th, he'd been with the team for a few weeks at that point, and this was really kind of his coming out party. So they're at the Polo Grounds where they played their home games, this decrepit dive of a stadium, which they had to use until their new stadium was built.
Right, because Shea wasn't built till 64.
That's
it wasn't
correct.
Finished.
Mm-hmm. So in the first inning, he's playing first base, and they catch a Cubs base runner in a rundown. Now, he had problems with rundowns all the time. It was beyond his skill set. So he started chasing the runner without the ball. And then the runner, seeing this, ran into him, which was a much more alert play on the runner's part than on Marv's part, because what that meant was that Marv was called for interference, and it was awarded the base. Now, because of that mistake, the Cubs went on to score four runs. So it's the bottom of the first, and the Mets are up, and they're already down 4-0.
Right.
Okay.
Because of Marvelous Marv.
Because of Marvelous Marv. That miscue of his led to four unearned runs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they get a couple of hits, and they score a run, and then Marv comes up, and there's two runners on base, and he hits a triple, just a massive shot, and he's standing on third base, and it's now 4-3, and they've got a runner on third, or so it appears.
Marvelous Marv.
Marvelous Marv is on third base. However, the Cubs' star first baseman, Ernie Banks, sees what just about everybody in the stadium has seen, which is that Marv didn't touch first base. Didn't even come close.
Mm-hmm.
So he calls for the ball, steps on the bag, and is called out by the umpire. Now, Stengel comes charging out of the dugout, knowing that Marv didn't touch first base, but feeling that he has to make an effort for the show of the thing. And he's intercepted by the second base umpire saying, "Don't bother, Casey. He didn't touch second base either." And Stengel's response is, "Well, I know damn well he touched third base because he's standing on it."
Yeah, poor Marvelous Marv. I mean, that was a game that, again, it's just there were so many things that went wrong. And it wasn't like this guy was always horrible, but it just seemed like things would kind of not work out in his favor.
Well, he was a legitimate ball player. Yeah. He would try, and he had some skill. And, I mean, he had 16 homers on a part-time regimen for this team. So, obviously, he had some skill. It's just that things happened to him.
Well, and even...
and the things that happened to him were things that happened to everybody on the team at one time or another.
Right.
But his mistakes happened at particularly dramatic times.
Yeah.
I mean, he would be the guy who the ball would go through his legs with two runners on base in the 15th inning of a tie game. He would be the guy who would strike out with, you know, the bases loaded and the team down by one run in the bottom of the ninth.
There's a great quote in here where... Lindsey Nelson, who was the radio announcer, said, "Marvelous Marv saved the worst of them for the best occasions regarding his mistakes, that they weren't ordinary mistakes. They always came at, you know, the worst mistakes at the best time," or however it would be, that, you know, really kind of fun stuff. I mean, and again, and Lindsey Nelson's a great character, you know, intentionally wearing ugly suits. I wish we could go on and on because there's so many fun stories in this. David, the last thing that I just want to mention is the poor dog, Homer the mascot.
Oh, Homer the Beagle.
Who
yes.
had been trained to run the bases, and they bring him out on a special day to run the bases, and the poor dog ran to first, and he had done it before successfully, but only during practice, right?
That's
runs
right.
to first, gets to second, and then turns around and just sort of runs straight into home, and kind of like Marvelous Marv.
Yep, the inevitable comparisons. Yeah, he was actually trained by the same trainer who schooled Lassie. And they had been working on this for months. It was supposed to be his signature stunt, that he would run the bases at the polo ground. They brought him out there, and everybody was sure that everything would work out, and the dog knew what he was supposed to do. And he took off for first and turned the corner sharply, looked real good, headed straight for second, and then turned the corner and headed across the pitcher's mound. And the best part I like about that story is it took six people, including three players, to try and run him down, because he was not going to be caught.
Well,
And then, of course, he's retired after that season and adopted by one of the Mets executives, who takes him to his home, and then they find that Homer, despite all his training, was not housebroken.
Travis DiNicola with author David Bagdad. His new book is titled A Year in Mudville, An Oral History of Casey Stengel and the Original Mets. It's published by Fortnite Books and is available through Amazon.com and through Apple iBooks. Bagdad is also a musician and has recently released a new CD, Rocky Shores of Home, a collection of original and traditional Celtic music performed on various stringed instruments. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what's even better than surprising your sweetie with a gift on Valentine's Day?
What could that be?
Surprising your sweetie with a gift a week later.
Ooh! Whether you forgot Valentine's Day or not, it's still a good time.
It's still a good time, and I have a suggestion for you to get that gift on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do? All right, Sharon, what is it?
The suggestion is go to the Indiana Art Fair, which is going on this weekend.
Yeah, that's the indoor art fair event. Very cool stuff.
The Indiana State Museum. Think Penrod, but on a smaller scale, and indoors, some amazing jewelers and ceramicists and glass artists. If you're hearing us on Friday night, you can go on Saturday from 10 to 5 or on Sunday from 11 to 5. It's free for members of the State Museum, $7 for non-members, and it's presented in part by the Indiana Artisan Development Program. Again, that's at the Indiana State Museum, the 8th annual Indiana Art Fair. I remember the first one.
Very cool. Hey, something going on this Sunday that would be a great concert to check out with your sweetie is the Philharmonic is featuring David Baker, the Indiana jazz giant, jazz composer. He's going to be speaking at a free listen and learn session at 2:30, immediately preceding the concert. And this is the Philharmonic concert that's going to be out at the Pike Performing Arts Center. Their 13th annual gospel concert with Reginald Walters, Charles Latshaw conductors, Pike Performing Arts Center, February 20th, 3 p.m., and the Symphonic Praise Choir, and along with David Baker being there, also local artist Nancy Noel is featuring her paintings at this concert also.
What?
Yeah. Inspirational day.
It should be a really great day. Again, you can get more information at philharmonicindy.org, but it's out at Pike on Sunday afternoon.
Excellent. Hey, you probably saw this. Props to the Indianapolis Star for doing the countdown to the Super Bowl with all sorts of great conversations about how we can become an even more super city than we already are. One way you can learn more about what we're doing as a city is to attend some of the Indy Talks events. That's put together by more than 20 organizations, and one of the upcoming events is this coming Tuesday, the 22nd, 7 to 9, at the Lakin Auditorium at the JCC. It's a free talk about the Indianapolis immigrant experience, Indianapolis immigrant experience, sponsored by Indy Talks. Free event this coming Tuesday, the 22nd, 7 to 9, at the Lakin Auditorium at the JCC. Go check it out.
Hey, if you happen to notice a lot of arts teachers and artists and arts administrators hanging out at the State House on Monday, it's because Monday the 21st is Arts Advocacy Day, Arts Day at the State House. The Indiana Coalition for the Arts is organizing this. It's the annual celebration to promote the arts and education in the schools as well as about everywhere else. And it's taking place from 1:30 to 6 p.m. in the State House Rotunda, along with a big awards ceremony at 3:30 for the Community Arts Leadership Awards that they are giving out as well. Definitely worth checking out if you're downtown near the State House between 1:30 and 6 on Monday.
Very good. Vote with your feet for the arts and go here this coming Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center. David Finkel, Wu Han, and Philip Setzer in an all Schubert program, the Opus 99 and Opus 100 piano trios, B-flat and E-flat major. Gorgeous, gorgeous music. And, hey, take your sweetie if you want, or take a friend. That's this coming Wednesday, 7:30, Ensemble Music Society presenting that concert.
And last thing I've got, Modus Dance Theater is doing sort of a pared-down version of their pairings performance. You got that?
I got it.
Taking place at the White Rabbit Cabaret down in Fountain Square this weekend. They've got shows Friday night, Saturday night, as well as Sunday, featuring the Modus Dance Company, which is a very, very cool modern dance company. And you can get more information at modusdance.com.
Very good. Hey, over the years, last note I have, but over the years, the McFadden Lecture, which is a great free lecture sponsored by the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, they've brought in some amazing speakers, and this year is no different. Bob Woodward, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, best-selling author. If you remember All the President's Men, or if you don't have a clue what that is, you want to put March 11th as a Friday on your calendar, 7 o'clock, free lecture, North Central High School. For more information, 275-4022. Bob Woodward.
Ooh, very exciting.
Exciting.
We'll have more ideas of things you can continue to do all around town in the arts with your sweetie next week on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The Rixweil Theater Company is producing Tuesdays with Maury, February 25th and 26th, and March 4th and 5th in Greenfield, and then taking the production on the road to three other venues. All proceeds will be donated to the ALS Association. Sharon Gamble recently spoke with Tom Corbett, the director, about his cast of Tom Johnson and Gary Roberts, and about how this popular Mitch album, book, and film translates to the stage.
How'd you get started directing?
Well, this is my first time sitting in the director's chair.
Cool.
Tom, who plays Maury Schwartz, I've been in other plays with him and with the gentleman who plays Mitch also. And these two decided to do this play as an off thing. They were between plays and said, hey, you know, we want to do something that's just two actors. And they chose this because it had a message. And then more or less just fell in love with the characters. And realized when they were trying to self-direct that they couldn't do that.
Sure.
They needed somebody to help give them some direction, and they asked me. And one thing led to another. So now I'm directing them in this play.
That's how things start. Mm-hmm. You have some acting background?
I do. I've been in several plays with in Carmel, with Westfield, and with Rick Swile out in Greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going on about 3 to 4 years now. I've lost track. I've been in several plays.
So I'm curious, though, as an actor, you've probably, having been in several projects now as an adult, you've probably observed different directing styles.
Mm-hmm.
When you were an actor, did you ever think, well, that's really useful. I'm going to remember that in case I'm ever a director. Or conversely, my director isn't helping me very much. What can I learn from that? Are there things that you draw from when you've been an actor as a director?
Yes. Not an easy answer to that.
Yeah.
Every play that I've been in, it's been a different venue. It's been a different situation. And so there's some times when I pulled on some past history and said, this is how that happened in that play, and they did that so well. And then I would call this a collaboration with all three of us. We're swapping ideas. You know, this is how he thinks it should look, how he thinks it should look, how it looks from out where I am. And we come to an agreement on what we want to do. So I'm not just pulling from my experience. I guess I'm pulling from Tom's experience and Gary's experience.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a lot of good experiences, and it all comes into play. Because my first time, that's what I have to call on.
Absolutely. It seems impossible that there'd be anyone listening to us who hasn't read Tuesdays with Maury or seen it on stage or seen it on screen. But just in case, would you describe the story and how it came about? Because it's autobiographical.
It is.
Yeah.
So Mitch Albom, back in the early 70s to late 70s, was a student at Brandeis University. And Maury Schwartz was one of his instructors, one of his professors of sociology. And they met in classes and were drawn to each other, developed a friendship outside of class. And then when Mitch graduated, then basically he went on with his life and Maury went on with his life. And 16 years later, they're back together. Mitch just happened to find out that Maury was dying of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and thought, well, I want to check in on him, say hi again, see how he's doing. Didn't think for a moment that it would develop into the friendship again. He had been gone so long, he figured, well, the professor is not going to remember me, and if he does, won't forgive me for staying out of his life that long when I promised to stay in touch.
Yeah.
But they'd start right back up where they left off. And so for 16 Tuesdays, there are several lessons, life lessons. Maury wants to teach, always being the teacher, wants to teach Mitch, and also leave behind something for all of us. So the plan early on was that his teachings, their last few times together, would be recorded and later put into a book for all of us and for Mitch to remember. So it was a plan for them to make a book, to write a book from the start, and then it developed into this wonderful book about Mitch, an old man, a young man, and life's lessons. And you're right. We've found, as we've been talking with people about this, oh, I read that in high school or in college. I saw the movie. And so it's been very interesting. And there is a message about how, not necessarily how short life is, but just how to be in life, how to behave.
Mm-hmm. Because everybody's going to face some challenges, some hardships, and everybody's going to die. I'm sorry, listeners, if you didn't know that.
he hates
to break it to you.
Yes. So later on, and I think he was 78 years old when he found out he had ALS, and he passed away just a little over a year later. So, but in that short amount of time, he was on Nightline 3 times, and that's how Mitch found out about him. Just happened to be scanning channels and saw that particular Nightline interview with Ted Koppel. And so that's in the play as well and in the book. And so anyway, that's how they reconnected. And it's very emotional.
Sure.
And so and a good strong message.
And you're doing a collaboration where you're raising some money for the ALS.
Mm-hmm. Part of the proceeds from each production will go to ALS, the ALS Association.
Yeah.
And we've got 12 shows. So we'll be out in Greenfield for four shows. We'll be in Franklin at a friend of a friend has a church down there, and they invited us down, and they're going to do a book study. And then we'll be in Westfield at the Westfield Playhouse for six shows.
That's great. Wonderful that you can move it around a little bit. A little bit of a challenge, too, though, because you have to figure out, make sure your set is portable and your lighting works in different spaces and all that kind of stuff. Good technical challenges. Did you have to, what was your personal history with the story? Did you read the book? Did you see the film? Had you seen the stage adaptation elsewhere?
No.
Well, that's kind of a good thing. You didn't have to unlearn anything.
So what I did do, though, when they came to me, I said, you know, I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned it to a friend. Oh, yeah, I read the book. I've got it. Here you go. So I read the book. And then I heard there was a movie adaptation, so I watched the movie. And then a couple of us did go to Lafayette, Indiana. They were doing a production. We went and saw theirs. And so it was very interesting. I learned a lot in a short amount of time.
You know, those three formats are so different.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way you express yourself in a memoir. You have all the time and space in the world in narrative writing.
Mm-hmm.
Film is something very different, and then translating to a stage play is yet a different beast again. How do you think the translation works to stage? What do you feel works best about the adaptations from, say, between the book to the stage play?
In a little over an hour, the play is about an hour and 10 to 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
No intermission.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking that book, and I can't tell you how many pages. It was an easy read. It was several pages long. Everything in that book has been condensed into the play. And that amazed me, how well written this play is.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't miss anything. There's a little bit of Mitch's family that the book discusses, some other things that says why he is the way he is in life. And that's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's not on the play. The play is strictly about Mitch and Maury. And again, very well written. You don't really miss anything. And they're taking you, they're keeping the set very simple. So the whole time you're basically at Maury's house.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we place the actors at different parts on the stage to say, okay, over here you're going to be, at this point, Mitch is in Wimbledon covering the tennis. And now he's back in Detroit here, or at this point in time they're at the doctor's office. But it's all, the stage doesn't change. The
mm-hmm.
set doesn't change. We're just placing them in different places to help the audience see we're at a different area. And there's some flashbacks, and as I mentioned earlier, some narration where they're actually stepping up and talking to the audience. And there's some direction in the play, the way it's written. There's director's notes, and then the rest, his suggestion is keep it simple.
Hmm.
You know, just stick with the message.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, and it's just done so well and so easy to do. So again, back to your question, though, the play is very well written. You don't really miss a whole lot from the book. And in the movie, naturally, I think they really stuck to the book when they did the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Except there you have all that scenery. You're going to those places. You're
right.
Actually feeling it even more. You're there with them. And we try to do that with the play. And it's done. It's very, very well written play.
You're a young man. How are you, we're having this conversation during the rehearsal process, how are you getting in the head of the Maury character? How are you helping your actor understand that person?
I don't have direct experience with ALS. I do with other diseases.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I think between the three of us, we're on the same level.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pulling from all of our experiences with death
mm-hmm.
and dying. With Gary is a teacher. I'm a coach. Tom does some coaching, or has in the past. So you're pulling from all those experiences. And as far as getting into his head, you're saying, what would what would he be saying as a professor? And I guess at our ages and with our experience, you can feel as a teacher, this is what he would be saying. As far as the death, again, having just experienced that for ourselves and other situations, family, friends, then you feel some of that too. Maybe his fear, the urgency to get this message out. He doesn't know how long he has left to live.
And the more the disease progresses, the harder it is to communicate.
Yes. It is a progressive disease, so he can't move. He starts out being able to walk, being able to dance, moves to a walker, moves to a wheelchair, and finally is bedridden. So you deal with that too. And the emotion around that and trying to bring the audience into some of his, what he's losing. And so, again, back to your question, it wasn't hard at all. With the three of us together, maybe how would I feel? And what does the audience see? What do we want to have them feel? And it became easier if we were out in the audience looking up there, trying to help them understand what was going on. Then we could understand it better. And it did help, though, to read the book.
And sure, sure. And I, again, for anybody who's not familiar with the book, the film, or the stage play, there is some humor in this. There's very much some lightness and some grace.
I'm glad you said that. Grace is a very good word.
Sharon Gamble with Tom Corbett, who's directing Tom Johnson as Maury, and Gary Roberts as Mitch in Tuesdays with Maury. You can see this Rixwell Theater Company production at Park Chapel Christian Church in Greenfield, February 25th and 26th, and March 4th and 5th. You can also see it at Grace United Methodist Church in Franklin on March 19th and 20th, and at the Westfield Playhouse in Westfield, April 8th, 9th, 10th, 15th, 16th, and 17th. All proceeds benefit the ALS Association. For more information, visit rickswile.blogspot.com. That's rickswile, rickswile.blogspot.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll chat with artist Jillian Ludwig about how food, farms, and art meet in her work.
I'll chat with composer Aaron J. Kernis, who's coming to Indiana.
And I'll find out about some local art teachers and what they're doing to encourage us all to support the arts in schools. Plus, we have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.